Hi, I'm Dan Webster, film critic for Spokane Public Radio and blogger for Spokane7.com.
And I'm Mary Pat Truthart, part-time film critic, full-time law professor at Gonzaga University School of Law.
And I'm Nathan Weinbender, also a film critic for Spokane Public Radio.
And welcome to Movies 101, the show that prefers its popcorn buttered, salted, and fresh out of the microwave. In our house, by the way, that typically means the Paul Newman brand, not Orville Redenbacher. Mary Pat and I munched on our home-brewed corn last week, not sure what Nathan was consuming, as we three watched a pair of films, both of which were available through streaming services. One was the documentary The Velvet Underground, a stylistic take on the New York band that, at least for a while, was an Andy Warhol pet project. The other is The Guilty, director Antoine Fuqua's adaptation of a 2018 Danish film about a troubled police officer, in Fuqua's film played by Jake Gyllenhaal. Let's begin this week's show by stepping into a time machine and heading back to New York of the 1960s. It was in 1964 that Lou Reed teamed with John Cale to form what would become known as the avant-garde band, the Velvet Underground. Though it would change personnel over the years and even for a while serve as a kind of house band for artist Andy Warhol's Factory, the group ultimately would record a number of albums that included such notable songs as Waiting for the Man and Sweet Jane, as well as serve as an influence on many bands that would follow. Director Todd Haynes, as versatile at making documentaries as he is at writing Oscar-nominated narrative films, explores the band's music and its legacy both by using the standard talking head technique, among those interviewed are the surviving band members Cale and drummer Mo Tucker, but also by employing the kind of abstract multi-screen effects that might make even Warhol himself smile with glee.
Well, this, I think we should say this up front, is that of the three of us, I am the biggest fan of the Velvet Underground going into this, of the band. They are one of my very, very favorite bands. And Todd Haynes is one of my favorite filmmakers working right now. And it just seemed like a match made in heaven, this director and this band. I mean, you look back at his career, and as you mentioned, this is his first documentary feature as a director. And the movies he's made in the past that are about music and the history of music have touched this era as well and have had kind of faux documentary elements to them. I mean, both his movie Velvet Goldmine, similar title, and also about a similar era of music, has sort of this kind of fake documentary thing running through it. His movie I'm Not There, which is kind of sort of about Bob Dylan.
Yeah, the Dylan one, yeah.
And Dylan comes up quite a bit in this documentary as well. There's playing around with fact and fiction in that movie too. So here we have a straight up documentary. But unlike a lot of the musical docs that we've been talking about in the last couple of years, and we've gotten a lot in the last couple of years, this one is, I think, more stylistically adventurous. And I appreciated that because so often we see these films that are about avant-garde or experimental or really out there artists, and the movies themselves are very conventional and buttoned down, and that's not the case with Haynes' version of The Velvet Underground. We get all of these techniques that are going on throughout the film that are reminiscent of, as you said, Andy Warhol's films from that time, of Jonas Mekas, his work, and he is a talking head in this movie. They interviewed him right before he died. Also people like Kenneth Anger, and I think I recognize some of his stuff as clips throughout this movie. So there are montages and pieces of film all being cut together as the footage of the band members are kind of talking about the history. And this movie has been getting unanimous praise, so I feel like I can nitpick a little bit here as a big fan of the band The Velvet Underground. I thought that this movie spends so much time talking about how radical and great New York in the 1960s was, and I have no doubt that's true, but I feel like that is well-trod territory. I think we've already seen documentaries about that very subject, including movies about people that are in this. Andy Warhol Superstar is one you can check out. Nico Icon, a member of the Velvet Underground for a short period of time. So I feel like there's a lot of throat clearing going on before we get to the music itself, which is what I was interested in. So maybe this is a selfish criticism on my part. And then once it gets into the music, it's thrilling to hear these songs again. And I saw it on a big screen. It's also streaming on Apple Plus right now. So getting to hear that music on a theater sound system was incredible. The archival footage that they have of the Velvet Underground is amazing because there's not much of it out there.
Not much, no, at all.
They were only a band for a short period of time, and there's not much documentation of them performing. There are live recordings, audio recordings you can get, but not much film footage. So it was great to see that stuff. And obviously, the collaboration between Cale and Reed is very important because you have Reed's sort of rockabilly kind of classic rock and roll roots. And then you have John Cale, who's the avant-garde experimental composer. And those two pieces of the puzzle are what made the Velvet Underground sound. So it's hugely important. But once Cale departs the band after two albums, Haynes kind of loses interest in it. And the movie wraps up real quick and skips over their last two records, which are just as great and groundbreaking and revolutionary as the first two. And they skip over Loaded, which is my favorite Velvet Underground record. So now I'm airing grievances in the public square because I think every Velvet Underground fan is going to have things that they're going to want covered in this movie, and they might not get them. Overall, though, it is a strong film and hopefully leads more people to what I think is a great band.
I think that's really important because, Nathan, you seemed sorely disappointed that Dan and I were not among the Cognoscenti.
Yeah, I just kind of assumed you were super fans.
And honestly, I came more to anything connected with the Velvet Underground through Lou Reed and his solo career. So I'm much more familiar with that. And he was touring different places where I was living because he would sort of vacillate between East Coast of the U.S. and then Europe. And so he played a lot in the Philadelphia area when I was there. So I had the opportunity to see him in that context.
Oh, wow. And he also vacillated between very accessible, even radio-friendly music and some of the least accessible music ever made.
Correct.
And his solo career could probably get its own documentary unto itself.
Right. So I think you're actually posing the question, so who's the audience for this? Because you, as a diehard fan, were disappointed because—
In some of it.
Yeah, in some of it. And for those of us who might be less familiar with the work of the Velvet Underground, but more familiar with the context in which this arose, I think it met my needs because I did learn more about the music than I might have been familiar with. I also was, frankly, intrigued by the whole— It was almost like the East Coast, West Coast rap split because at various points they were really kind of pointing fingers to the hippies out on the West Coast and, you know, we're the real musicians. And,
yeah.
You know,
Mo Tucker even says, like, right. We hated hippies.
And I'm not sure that I fully understood that division. And they brought that to the fore. And of course, you think of this time period, the Factory and Andy Warhol, and even though since that time, things have come out about how people were used and abused, and it wasn't the best place for women to be because it really was the sort of classic objectification culture that was highlighted. And I think the documentary obviously points that out. So, I mean, I think it places some of these things in a context that we're already familiar with, but gives it a little bit different spin. But you're right. Maybe it's trying to do too much. And that, I think, would be the main criticism. Because if it didn't get to the later stage of Velvet Underground stuff that really resonated for you, then I think that probably is a failing in the movie.
You know, I think one of the problems, and maybe it would have fixed things for you, Nathan, is the title itself, The Velvet Underground, because you immediately think, oh, it's going to be the documentary that explains everything the Velvet Underground was. And it's not that at all. And in fact, I think that he uses the title more as a description of that time in New York. Because for me, I was less interested in the music than I was taking film courses in the early 70s, not long after Warhol and Paul Morrissey began their collaboration, making movies like Hustler. And in the courses I took, we would sit through hours and hours and hours of Hustler and I can't even name all the other movies.
Flesh, you know, and
exactly,
Heat and Trash.
Exactly.
And, all those,
and yeah. So I was really surprised and delighted to see how Haynes used all those film techniques that were developed then, and he gave them new life. So as a cinematic package, I really appreciated The Velvet Underground.
Yeah, and I
take your point that the music gets second fiddle.
A little bit, yeah. Although I agree with you about the cinematic aspect of this because, I mean, we've been complaining about this forever that so many documentaries kind of forget that they also have to be movies. And Haynes has not forgotten that part. There's this really effective and I think beautiful technique he uses as he's introducing Lou Reed and John Cale, where he has these film loops of them that I presume were taken at the factory, maybe even by Warhol himself. And so you have Lou Reed just looking at you
right.
in this long extended loop.
For minutes, without blinking.
Yeah, for 5 or 10 minutes while he and other people explain who he was and what his background was. I also appreciated the fact that he does not come across as a saint, which, of course, Lou Reed was never synonymous with
he was supposedly a bit of a jerk.
But yeah, the fact that he was really difficult to work with, I appreciate the fact that this wasn't an all rose-colored lenses kind of movie. And you don't get that sense with Cale either. You got the sense that they were both geniuses but brilliant to work with. And I think it says something that even though the Velvet Underground kind of imploded within 4 or 5 years of existing, they all still worked together. They all collaborated till the end of both Nico's life and Sterling Morrison's life and Lou Reed's life. They were all working together and staying in touch. So obviously there was something special there, even if, you know, they weren't around for very long.
No, well, how many great rock bands were around for any length of time?
That's true. That's true.
And that was Todd Haynes' documentary, The Velvet Underground. This is Movies 101, and it's time to take a short break. Before we go, remember that you can access podcasts of Movies 101 by going online at SpokanePublicRadio.org. While there, check out the individual reviews that Nathan and I write. Don't do it now, though, because we'll be right back to look at The Guilty. You're listening to Movies 101 on Spokane Public Radio. And we're back. This is Movies 101, and I'm your host, Dan Webster. During the first half of the show, Mary Pat Truthart, Nathan Weinbinder, and I discussed the Todd Haynes documentary, The Velvet Underground. Let's now move to something quite different, Antoine Fuqua's adaptation of a 2018 Danish film, the English translation of which is The Guilty. It's just as common for American remakes of foreign films to fail as for them to succeed. You can place The Guilty, Antoine Fuqua's remake of Danish filmmaker Gustav Møller's film Den Skilje, in the latter category. Instead of the cool Nordic arrogance of Møller's protagonist, played by Jakob Cedergren, Fuqua opts to make his lead character, Joe Baylor, as played by Jake Gyllenhaal, a streetwise, tattooed, and rage-filled member of the Los Angeles Police Department, taken off regular patrol and facing an impending trial for an at-first unexplained incident, Baylor is assigned to dispatch duty. And on the first night before his trial, he receives a call from a woman who claims to have been abducted. Jumping to all sorts of conclusions, Baylor proceeds with the same kind of fervor he likely brought to the street, alienating nearly everyone in his quest for his kind of justice and ultimately some sense of personal redemption. Fuqua, a talented if scattershot veteran filmmaker, is perhaps best known for directing 2001's Training Day, the film that won Denzel Washington his second Academy Award and his first in the Best Actor category. Here, Fuqua does a lot in a limited space of a police dispatch office. Lucky for him, he has a versatile, talented actor in Gyllenhaal on whom to depend.
This movie I was skeptical about because having seen the Danish film, I just wasn't sure how this was going to translate to Los Angeles and to having Jake Gyllenhaal as the prime character, really the only character on whose attention we are focused for an hour and a half.
Yeah.
And so The Guilty, Dan, as you pointed out in your introduction, whereas the Nordic version was ice, this version is literally and figuratively fire, for better or for worse, because I do think that the contrast in the way that these two films play out is quite different. And that's largely due to Gyllenhaal's performance. You really have to be a special actor to be able to command the screen for that length of time.
Yeah, weren't you thinking of Locke, the Tom Hardy?
Yes,
yeah.
Exactly.
Rain Nights movie.
Exactly, where he's
Tom
driving
Hardy
in the car.
The whole time,
right?
Yeah.
Now, this is expanded just a little bit so that we can see some other things happening in the background in a way that the Danish film was not. But at the same time, it's basically Gyllenhaal's movie, and it's going to rise and fall on his performance. And I thought he did pull it off. I felt as though we don't know a whole lot about him. We don't know a whole lot about what's happening with this crime. And it's a gradual reveal on both fronts. And then all of a sudden, everything comes together in a way where we are pulled off center, as is he. So I thought that the guilty may not be something that appeals to everyone. But I do think, I mean, we could just see the sort of fervor and the fire that is burning in this man. And then it's constantly, there are these big screens of these fires that are happening all around California. And so,
in case we didn't get the point, yeah.
Yeah, in case we needed to underscore that even more. But we do find out about him. We do find out about his personal life. We do find out about his career. And we find out even more slowly what's happening in this car, where he has made some decisions and determinations using his sixth sense as a police officer and his streetwise smarts. But we do, in the end, appreciate that things are not always as they seem, and that can either make one a hero or, you know, a pariah, depending on how things ultimately play out.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's kind of the central theme of both movies, is what's the definition of a hero? What's the definition of a victim? Because we find out unsettling things about various parties on either side of this call that might change our allegiances or make us question our assumptions about people based on very limited information. And my problem with this version of the guilty is that I've seen the original version of the guilty and I can't unsee it. I don't know how I would have reacted to the Fuqua version had I not seen that original Danish version. But I remember quite vividly the experience of seeing that first movie, because there are various things that start to dawn on you where you as you're watching it, you go, oh, we're really not going to leave this police precinct. Oh, it's really just going to be this guy. And that dawning realization is part of the thrill of the movie. And then as the various plot twists come, we're pulled more and more into it. And I really love that original movie. I think it's streaming out there on Hulu, maybe. This new one is on Netflix. But if you want to watch the original one, it's out there too. And if my memory is right, they're pretty close in terms of plot beats.
At least the first half. Yeah, they're almost identical.
Yeah, yeah. And I guess if you have to make the choice between which version of the guilty to see, it's obvious you see the Danish version, because I think it's better in pretty much every regard. I think it's an interesting movie as both a remake and as a COVID era production, because this was supposedly made at the height of lockdowns, and Antoine Fuqua almost directed this off site, where he, you know, Jake Gyllenhaal was alone in a room and Fuqua was like in a truck nearby or something. I read an interview with him. And so I guess as a snapshot of, and of course the fact that the entire city is on fire, obviously that plays into current events, but yeah, I don't know. I didn't think that this was anything special. You're right that these one performance movies rise and fall on the strength of the one performance. I thought Gyllenhaal was fine. I mean, I don't think he was doing anything earth-shaking. I don't think that this is one of his best performances, but it's solid. I should also say with a caveat that I watched this on an airplane, so
yes,
it's totally possible that that's feeding into this. But
yeah, you didn't have any leg room, and so consequently,
I'm down on the movie. But I don't think – I think I know my tastes enough to know that I don't think I would have been that big of a fan of this had I seen it in a theater.
I don't know. You know, so much of our reaction, at least our initial reaction, is the perspective that we bring to it. And, you know, I'm not a big fan of Antoine Fuqua. I never liked Training Day. I think – his reconfiguration. I just that's something we could devote a whole show about that. And I think that
you're down on him because of the remake of The Magnificent Seven.
Remake.
Yeah.
His travesty of a reconfiguration of one of the great Western films ever made. Oh, I swear to God, so horrible. But at any rate, so I was pleasantly surprised that he was as, I don't know, as subtle at least in Fuqua terms, in making this movie, and that he depended so much upon what Gyllenhaal is able to bring. I actually liked this movie, and I liked what he had to do. But again, just as I think your view is shaped by the fact that you could not forget the Danish movie, Nathan, and that you were on an airplane, my perspective is shaped largely because I was expecting to not like this movie, and I ended up liking it much more than I thought I was going to.
So basically, we have these two men, one the director and two the protagonist. And so I think that I did find it fascinating, Dan, because I know that you're not a Fuqua fan, and he has had a really varied career. I mean, didn't he do King Arthur?
Yes.
I mean, like,
He did this really
strange grouping of films. But when we come back to Gyllenhaal, I have begun to maybe appreciate what he brings more and more, because I do think that he has some comedic talent. I do think that, you know, and I'm putting aside like The Zodiac Killer or Brokeback Mountain. I mean, I do think that he's more of a full blown actor than I thought. Yeah, than I thought he was originally.
That's the LA movie to see with Jake Gyllenhaal.
Right, that's true. That's true. But I thought he was maybe sort of a pretty face who was kind of riding on the coattails of his sister. I do think it's interesting that in this film, like, we do have voices provided by Riley Keough and his brother-in-law, Peter Sarsgaard, Ethan Hawke. And I think that was sort of interesting to hear those voices and figure out who was saying what. But The Guilty, again, I agree with you, Nathan. If you had to choose only one, I'd see the Danish version. But I think this is the perfect kind of movie. You know, it's an hour and a half long. It's pretty tight that, you know, you could enjoy even maybe on a plane.
Maybe I saw it in under ideal circumstances.
All right, you guys both preferring. So tell me in Danish, what was the name of that movie? Come on, pronounce it.
Der Guilty.
No clue.
Den Skilje. And that's I was kind of
going a more Bavarian route.
I know. Where's Pia when we need her?
Yeah, right, exactly. Yeah. Pia Hallenberg. And that was The Guilty, or Den Skilje in Danish terms. And this is Movies 101. I'm Dan Webster. And early in the show, Nathan Weinbender, Pat Truthart, and I discussed Todd Haynes' documentary, The Velvet Underground. Let's take this moment to thank Peter Glarberg for both producing and engineering the show. And we thank you to our loyal listeners. We invite you back next week, same time, same spot on the radio dial, when we'll again check out all the best that cinema has to offer, wherever we can find it. Until then, remember these words from the German filmmaker Wim Wenders. That's how it begins, making a film, writing a book, painting a picture, composing a tune, generally creating something. You have a wish. You wish that something might exist, and then you work on it until it does. You're listening to Movies 101 on Spokane Public Radio.
The Movies 101 podcast is made possible by the members of Spokane Public Radio. Become a member at SpokanePublicRadio.org. Thanks for listening to Movies 101.